Yes, we're talking about the supernatural with Lee Strieber with us, Jeffrey Kripal as well, and we'll get right back to both of them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Whitley Strieber with us, Jeffrey Kripal as well. Okay, Whitley, you've had some enlightening stories in there, but you've also got some scary ones too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are a few scary ones here and there, George. It's there's a lot of stuff that happens that I find really very difficult to handle and to explain, and I go through a lot of experiences that are, in fact, I haven't really talked about before because I couldn't, and some of them were. But like, for example, we had a situation where Annie had a miscarriage, and she was a little older, and we were a little late with the second time for another child. And the night it happened, a little bit before it happened, I woke up and saw one of these dark figures on the foot of our bed, and it jumped up and disappeared the minute I woke up. And then an hour later, we were dealing with this other situation. And that haunts me to this day. I don't know if it was connected or not, or even if there was really anything there. And, and of course, the other side of the coin is something like the implant, which has, it seems to me that Anne was right about it, that it has given me a way of looking at the world that is really pretty unique and pretty amazing. It's like a gift in a way. And people say, well, it must be used something to do with mind control. No, it's not. It's anything but. It's something to do with a new kind of freedom, it seems to me. And so, there's the very, very dark side and the much more interesting light side. And I'll give you another example of the kind of things that used to happen. Our son had a friend up there, and he remembers virtually nothing of any of this, so he says. So, but in any case, I remember it all very vividly.
Okay.
Had a boy up there, and at this time, this was back in the days in the early 90s when the sort of lady who's on the cover of Communion was around a lot. And this boy was kind of wild, and he had done something. He'd like stuck his tongue in a light socket one time.
Oh, my God.
Did crazy things. And she did not like this kid. I could tell. I mean, she wasn't physically present, but she was there. And during the night, what happened was he kept waking up and seeing what I knew to be her fingers, which are long and snaky and kind of had dark claws on the end of them, come around the door of the bedroom and sort of scratch the door, surface of the door, and then go back again. And I kept seeing her, glimpsing her. I knew she was in the house because Ann and I would know that because she was really hard to catch sight of, but was when they were there, you could feel it. There was somebody in the house. So the next morning, this kid, he tells me at breakfast, he tells me what happened. He's wide-eyed. And I thought to myself, I had a feeling this would happen. He never came again. We never saw him again. He went home, he closed the door, and that was it. And it's very understandable. So we were spared having this kind of crazy kid in our lives. So it was a really interesting, it was just a whole life like this that were in our lives. And it was, as I say, it was just absolutely fascinating. People want to say it's good. They want to say it's evil. I want to say it's being alive in a completely new way. And it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, what do you think, because it's happened to you, what is this abduction phenomena? What is going on?
If anyone had a final and clear answer to that question, I think there would be disclosure the next day. But we don't. I don't know if you're physically taken or not. I don't even know that. I feel that I was, because I was physically beat up after the first time it happened.
And we get reports, as you know, Whitley, from people who say, I saw the body floating through the ceiling, and then other people say it was always in bed. So they had this experience, but they physically never went anywhere.
Well, how, here's one for the books. This happened to me. There's a lot of new stuff in Supernatural, but this happened. It's the opposite of an out-of-the-body experience. The body was out of me. I woke up in the middle of the night, very suddenly, and there was no one there. In other words, I was in the bed, I was conscious, but I had no body. There was just sheets. I was not there. And I thought, my God, now what? And I thought, I'm going to have to figure out how to find my body. I mean, it was bizarre, but it doesn't end there. I did, as soon as I tried to move, because I figured I'm going to go looking for it through the house. Where could it be? As soon as I started to move, I went down through the ceiling, through the floor, into the bedroom below, where Andrew was, the little boy, another little boy were sleeping. Not the same kid that I talked about earlier. Only they weren't. And my body was standing there talking to the other kid. And I got into my body. And I didn't know what I'd been saying. He was looking up at me like I was about to say something else. And so I said, well, good night, boys, and went back upstairs. And I thought to myself, that was got to be the weirdest dream or whatever it was I've ever had. It tops them all. So I finally went back to sleep. In the morning, as always, I was religious about this. I told Annie the whole thing in the bedroom quietly. We go downstairs. She's making dinner. All of a sudden, the boys' room door opens, and they come running out and saying, Whitley came down through the ceiling in the middle of the night.
Ah.
And how do you get, I mean, it is at once so disturbing and so fantastically cool that things like that could happen. But it went on. Because that day I was taking this little boy to meet his dad, and they had a house in the Delaware Water Gap, and we had this house up in Ulster County in New York. So we would meet in the middle, kind of in Jersey, and exchange boys over the course of the summer. So I was taking this boy there, and I took a turn out of, in Paramus, New Jersey, to go to an overpass to come back to the other side of a divided highway where we had seen his dad sitting there in his truck waiting for us, and his dad had seen us. Only instead of going up to the overpass, we went down into a sunken highway that I didn't even know was there. And I thought, whoa, what's going on here? And I figured, well, you know, I didn't know this was here. I'll just take the next exit. So I took the exit, and we were in another world.
What do you mean?
We were going down these broad streets with grass on the verges and lots of trees. It was sunny, and you could see sunlight dappling down through the trees. It had been cloudy in Paramus, and there were these fairly sinister looking low houses set back up on the lawns, made of what looked like sandstone with kind of snakes, kind of big snakes, kind of in relief in them, and little arched doorways. And the boy starts trying to jump out of the car. I mean, he's freaking. And he's pulling up the automatic lock, and I'm pushing it down. He's pulling it up. I'm pushing it down. He's pulling it up. And I'm driving around trying to figure out how to get out of this insane situation. And finally, I see a kind of rough area beyond the neighborhood, kind of like a sort of vacant, unbuilt area. And I drive out into it. I'm in a Jeep, so this is not difficult.
Right.
And I see in the distance cars. So I go that way. And I get onto the, and it turned out to be, it's Route 80, 20 miles from where we got off in Paramus, off of 17 in Paramus, 5 minutes before. So I get us back to 17. I get us back to Paramus. By this time, the dad is standing in the bed of his pickup looking for us because, you know, he saw us, and then we just never came
and
back.
And you were gone.
We were gone. So I'm hoping, the father is ultra skeptical. He has actually taken both boys to his place and explained to my son also, Whitley is full of it. This cannot be true. None of it is true. Don't believe a word of it. Whatever's going on with him, we don't know. But this is not real. So,
does that bother you when people still say that?
No, it doesn't bother me because they have a right to say that because I have not proved a thing. I'm just telling things. Like I said, one of the things behind Supernatural is people make a mistake when they think that I'm making claims. I'm not. I'm describing perceptions. There's a huge difference. But here's what happened next. I haven't said, the boy and I during this entire time have not said a word to each other. Not a word. I haven't said a word. He hasn't said a word. So he jumps out of the car, and I'm hoping he's just going to get in his dad's truck and they're going to go home. Instead, he goes running across the parking lot yelling, Daddy, Daddy, Whitley just took me on a trip through the Twilight Zone.
Oh, great.
And so,
just what a father wants to hear, right?
The dad goes to town. We end up going through the neighborhood with maps. This is before GPS. And marking off on the maps with a ballpoint pen every street until we have gone down all the streets. We never find that area again.
Never.
Never. And this is my life.
Constantly.
And, I mean, and this is what the thing that's beautiful about Jeff is. He brings perspective to things like that.
Well, let's bring Jeff in for a second.
Yeah.
Jeffrey, you're aware of the criticisms about Whitley. He's aware of that. What do you think?
Well, I think he had these experiences, and I think they fit very well into what we can show in the history of religions and people's other anomalous or strange experiences. You know, just to give you a few examples, you know, the story he just told about floating down into his son's room and them seeing him there while his physical body was probably still in bed is, again, a kind of classic bilocation scene, which we see over and over and over again in the lives of the saints. The implant looks to me a lot like what we see in shamanic literature where a god or some kind of being comes and implants a magical stone or an object into the shaman's body, and the object signals a vocation, a calling to a particular way of life and among the community. The fear and the horror that he's experienced, again, makes perfect sense. People's encounter with what we call the sacred, it's not all love and light. When people encounter God in the Bible, for example, you're as likely to be killed by it as you are redeemed by it. The sacred is deeply attractive, but also deeply scary. So a lot of these things make really good sense to me in the sense that other people have experienced them. They don't make sense to me in the sense that I can explain them. I cannot, nor can Whitley. And that's what I admire so much about him. He's telling us what he experienced, and then he's trying to make sense of it. And like the rest of us, he fails. But all the more power to him. It's the honesty and the transparency that's so remarkable to me as someone who studies these things historically. You know, I can't get back to these shamans and saints in the literature. They're all in the past. But, you know, I can pick up the phone and talk to Whitley. And so that's a remarkable experience for me. I'm up close and personal with the sorts of things I study in the texts and in the history.
Some believe that Whitley's a CIA agent.
Oh, dear. You know, the one thing I missed was the pension.
That's right. You never got that.
I didn't get the money. But, no, you know where that started is really fascinating.
Whitley, can I think about that before you
go? Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I mean, the simplest response to that, again, is a historical one. All these experiences are in the historical record. They go back hundreds and thousands of years. You do not need the CIA to have these stories. So I don't buy that. I think that's a way of dismissing the experiences again and creating a kind of paranoia around them.
I would agree with you, Jeff.
Yeah.
I don't think you're in the CIA, Whitley. I'm sorry.
Well, no, neither do I. Neither is the CIA, I would guess.
Walk into Langley. Let's see how far you get, right?
Not far. You know, but I will say where I think it started. There was a fake memo created years and years ago where it's a letter, allegedly, from John Alexander, who you've had on the show, I'm sure.
Right, many times.
Whom I've known for God knows nearly 30 years now. But this letter is from before that, and it's about activating me and Dick Hoagland. And it's not a real letter. It never happened. In fact, John's rank is misstated in the letter.
He was a colonel, wasn't he?
This letter is misstating his own rank.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem too likely. But anyway, that sort of started the ball rolling with those conspiracy theories about me. There would inevitably be conspiracy theories about me. People want things to make sense. And I don't make sense, and that's too bad.
All right, now who came up with the title, The Supernatural? Was that you, Jeff, or Mitch?
Well, no, I did. I used that exact phrase in my textbook to talk about the paranormal. And I proposed that to Whitley as an accurate description of his own views, and we went from there.
The subtitle, A New Vision of the Unexplained.
That was mine.
That was you.
Yeah, so we did it together, kind of. But the thing about supernatural with the space between the two words.
I caught that right away.
Yeah, that is so critical, because what we're saying here is that this whole level of perception that we have been rejecting or explaining away throughout our entire history is real and can be subjected to academic and scientific scrutiny. Now, we do have the tools. We could figure it out. It's just a question of facing the fact that it is real, that it is unknown, and that it can be studied. Now, if there is somebody behind the scenes who is preventing that kind of study, that's another story.
All right, we're going to come back and talk about that other story, Whitley, in just a moment. And next hour, we'll open up all the phone lines to take all your questions. Welcome back. Whitley Strieber with us, along with Jeffrey Kripal, and both of them, of course, authors of the latest book, The Supernatural. Whitley, you've had some pretty home run hitters have looked at the book, including Jacques Vallée.
Yeah, that's true. We've had some fabulous reviews, I have to admit. Kirkus Reviews, which is frankly a really difficult reviewer, gave it a great review. Texas Monthly said some nice things about it. It's a couple of newspapers. It's some good reviews are coming in. But the thing that Jacques said that was so beautiful is this. What is at stake is nothing less than the nature of our reality and our ability as humans to grasp levels of perception that are once so dangerous and so sublime. And George, that's my life. I mean, that is what I have had, is my life experience. And I just keep thinking to myself, we can do this. We can make this make sense, because there is something real here. And we have the tools, and we outline in the book what they are, to understand this.
I want, and we'll get into some of those tools in a second, but Whitley, I want you to tell us your views of what you think this is all about. What is this?
Well, look, you know, I'm much more of a believer in the physical side of this, I think, than Jeff is. And when you read through the book, you know, he's really iffy about how physical it is. To me, it's very physical. And whether that means that something is happening to me that causes me to readdress reality in a different way so that it feels physical to me, even though it actually isn't, I don't know. I have to respect that possibility. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if it didn't turn out to be, I hate to say aliens, because I can't believe they would be that different from us. I know that Carl Sagan said they would be incredibly different from us, and he was a wise man, but I mean, he also didn't believe they could even get here, so.
But see, we're still not sure, though we have our...
We're not sure, but there. I think there's something ultimately that they're physical. That if you absolutely got one of them in a situation where it couldn't get out, it would be physically there. That's what I think. But as to what it is, boy, I mean, you know, you just got me. I'm not sure.
Jeff, let's bring you in on this, too. What do you think's going on, Jeff?
Well, I mean, this is the basis of our conversation in the book. I am by no means skeptical of Whitley's physical experience of them. I honor that. My critique of the interpretation of these as physical objects or physical creatures is that what you really have in the contact literature is also about subjects. It's ultimately about forms of mind encountering something in the environment. And my own gut feeling is that these things are somehow us. And by us, I don't mean George or Whitley or Jeff or Susan or Mary. I mean some other kind of form of mind, cosmic mind, that's not necessarily particularized as an individual yet. And that when it interacts with the human brain and a body, it creates a kind of movie or a kind of visionary display that we experience as physical in the environment. But there's something else behind that display, some form of mind that is somehow ours as well. And I think that's why these experiences are often described as uncanny. In other words, they're very, very other. They're very, very scary because they're so other, and yet they're oddly familiar. There's a sense of it that we know. So that's my best guess, but again, I don't know that. And that's the spirit of the book, is two men having a deeply respectful, deeply honest conversation about these sorts of strange things.
Yeah, I mean, we can disagree without getting into a big... In fact, that level of disagreement is essential in this. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to really get to the bottom of it, because it is unknown.
Well, Whitley, remember the movie, one of our favorites, Contact, which came from the book by Carl Sagan, of course. And when the alien was talking to Ellie, played by Jodie Foster, on the beach, you know, they were talking about how they're still questing to find out about basically God, too. They're mixed up. They want answers, and they're searching for the same thing we're searching for. I'm not sure we'll ever get those answers.
I have a feeling that it would, Well, you know, there's a very interesting, I'm going to just change my thought here for a minute, thing that appeared in the magazine Science in, gosh, it's been a while, in 1977, in April of 1977. I'm getting older, but I don't have any memory problems. And it was by D.B.H. Kuiper, who the astronomer who eventually discovered the Kuiper belt, and Mark Morris, a physicist, speculating about why it would be that if aliens were here, they would be very secretive. And they theorized that anyone who could travel the stars like that could get here would know almost everything. And what they would be here for would be looking for something new, for innovation, for new ideas. And they would therefore hide and stay in the shadows, because as soon as they showed themselves to us, we would immediately forget all of our new ideas and start looking at them and trying to figure out, you know, what can we get out of them? The Westerners showed up in more primitive tribes and so forth, the first thing people wanted was, the hell with this flint knife I'm dealing with. I want that nice stainless steel knife. How am I going to get it? And so they would be secretive. They would hide. And going from that and looking at ourselves, what if we were able to travel to other planets? Would we really land and show ourselves? The answer is no way. Our anthropologists would say, don't you dare show yourselves. Let us study these people. Let us learn from them. And if they were the only thing that we had ever found that really gave us a chance of discovering something new, we would almost be addicted to them. Isn't that fascinating? Do you suppose that's what's happening? Could be.
Could be.
George, can I speak to the God issue and whether we'll ever know?
Yes, that's very appropriate for you too. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so this, we get at this in the book, and this is why I bring in comparative mystical literature. In other words, literature written by people who claim to have some direct experience of God or the divine. And what's so important to understand there is that we have to distinguish between consciousness and cognition. In other words, cognition is the function of the brain. It's how we think. It's the logic. It's the thoughts we have. It's thinking about something. And a mystical experience is not that. It's becoming something. It's becoming a different form of mind or consciousness. So one can have a direct experience of another form of consciousness without being able to think it at all. In fact, thinking is precisely what prevents you from having such an experience. So I would agree with the Contact movie that, you know, we can't think consciousness. We can't think cosmic mind, because thinking is just a piece of software and hardware that a primitive primate is running on at the moment. But what we're likely seeing in these contact experiences is direct or fairly direct encounters with a form of mind that is not part of this software or hardware at all. And that's I think why it's so confusing to us. We simply are not evolved with our senses or our cognitive makeup to understand it.
Should we be?
Well, whether we should or not, we are. Human beings have been seeking out these experiences from the dawn of time. And they have, these same sorts of experiences have been guiding civilization. I mean, we even have stories and mythologies about these sorts of sky beings, you know, bestowing agriculture and technology and all kinds of practical skills on humanity. So I don't think it's a question of should or should not. It just is. And whatever these forms of mind are, they clearly want to interact with us, but they want to interact in ways that are largely secretive and often very, very tricky.
So,
and I think that's that's the question here, is how should we respond? What kind of relationship should we take in relationship to these other forms of mind, which again might be us?
But I'm concerned, Jeff and Whitley, that entities that work in the cloak of literally darkness, doing things without our approval, and Whitley, you didn't approve these things that happened to you. They're violating people. They're doing something that to me is unacceptable.
Well, then, if I could speak to that, I mean, every night that I go to sleep and I dream, some form of mind in me is doing things to me that I don't agree to. I don't consciously write my dreams, and I often have disturbing dreams that I don't like. So there's a part of me doing things to another part of me that Jeff as an ego has absolutely no control over. So I think your question and concern is an understandable one, but it presumes that our egos are somehow primary and are somehow set up or should lead the show here. And I think that's questionable. I think that's certainly part of the situation we're in. But clearly we're driven by all sorts of things every day, every moment of our lives that we're not aware of. It's just part of being a human being in some basic way.
Whitley?
Well, yeah, the other thing of the side of the coin is that the first time it happened, I did not expect it. And I can't say that I wanted it. I didn't know it could even happen. But I went for it after that. I went out into the woods and started trying to engage alone in the middle of the night. And that's when they came back. They didn't come back after. You know, the first time, I agree with you, it seems it was totally arbitrary, and I didn't call it in or anything like that. But after that, I did. I definitely did. I very intentionally did.
David Jacobs thinks there's something very evil going on here, Whitley.
Yeah, I don't think he knows enough about it, and I don't trust that whole strain of the whole UFO thing. It's too concretized, and they know everything, and they know what's going on, and they've got all this stuff, and it's all based on amateur hypnosis and stuff. We can do better than that, I'm afraid.
I also worry about that, George, from what I know.
Mm-hmm.
From the history of Christianity. I mean, very early in the history of Christianity, by the second, third centuries, the Christians are referring to the gods and spirits of other religions as demons. They're demonizing other people's religious experiences to prop up their own system. And of course, they're not unique. All sorts of religious traditions do that. They demonize religious experiences of people that don't fit into their system or doctrine. So any language of demons or demonizing makes me very, very nervous, because historically that has produced very bad behavior and led to all sorts of persecutions and all sorts of just really bad things. So I would deeply caution people to think twice about that. Having said that, it's clear that sometimes people's contact experiences are negative. Just like some near-death experiences are profoundly negative. We have to honor the dark or the negative side of the sacred, just like we honor the positive or bright side. It's all there. It's all part of the picture. And we need more nuance, and we need more complexity here.
Whitley, I think there's a breeding program going on here.
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? You know, my reaction would be, but based on, again, how I've lived and what I've seen.
And what's happened to you.
And what's happened to me, I can't deny some possibility like that. And once again, if we get back to the alien scenario, if it is aliens here, well, thank God they are interested in us and not, say, the porcupines, because that would be a little disappointing, wouldn't it? And inevitably, if we went to if we went to another world, we would poke them and prod them. We would take their sexual material and DNA, and depending on who it was, we might even breed them. I mean, depending on what culture. I can see certain cultures right now in our world who would not find that to be wrong, who would not consider that morally wrong, and who might not even consider it legally wrong, and would do it. And, you know, that gets me to the being, I wouldn't call him a child, who was in my woods behind our house right before we moved to Texas. This being was real. He was looked the size of an older child. He was terribly agitated, extremely shy, smoking all the time, like a schizophrenic or something. Somebody, he was seemed disturbed, and hung out in our woods. And then when we moved to Texas, he shows up in the condo complex. He was real. He was absolutely real. I mean, people called social services because they could see him in the place and he didn't belong there. Apparently a child, he's doing weird things. And he turned out to be living with these two men who were absolutely terrifying, who just seemed to exude a sense of evil, in an apartment right behind ours that was actually not supposed to be occupied, and they were eventually evicted because they were squatters. But what was all that about? Who were these people?
Well, I want to talk with you, Whitley, about black-eyed children when we come back and get your take on that. Plus, of course, we will take your phone calls for both Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey Kripal as we talk about their work, The Supernatural. Final hour to come right here on Coast to Coast AM. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and definitely send me an email whenever you want about anything with the show, George@coasttocoastam.com.